Recently, a member asked me, where are we now in Bible prophecy? As I thought about the member's question, I realized it's been some time since I've spoken on prophecy, although we did do Daniel 2 recently. But previously, the congregation years ago had requested a study on the book of Revelation. You remember that? And we covered Revelation from June 2004 to August 2007. That meant for 3 years, we focused on prophecy every month. We had, you know, just about every month. We didn't have one every month. And after that, I think we all agreed we needed a break. But the member's question showed me it's time for the break to be over, maybe it's been a little while. Well, we do want to understand where we are in prophecy, and today we can begin with a brief overview of Revelation 17. We'll just pick up some things in Revelation 17, because there are some time things in there that will help us understand where we are. Now, you'll remember that Revelation 17 is about the woman riding a beast. That's the first 6 verses, which we'll cover briefly. I won't cover them in great detail, but just briefly. Verses 1 and 2, then one of the 7 angels who had the 7 bowls came and talked with me, saying, come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot, who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So here John is shown in vision a great harlot who sits on many waters. In the Bible, a woman is often used to represent a nation or a church. In Revelation, there are 2 women mentioned, a righteous one and an unrighteous one. And he said, come and I will show, he said, the angel said, come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot. A harlot, of course, is sexually permissive, usually for payment. The picture given denotes spiritual harlotry. This is spiritual harlotry. It's a church that's being talked about. Who sits on many waters. When I start talking, all of a sudden the head starts giving me troubles here. It'll ease up in a minute, I hope. Let me try some more ginger juice. That always helps. Spokesman's Club need to note that conversation is one level of speaking, but speaking is another level. It's not the same thing. You have to project, and when you project, you rattle things. It says, who sits on many waters. In Revelation 17:15, we're told what the waters are. Then he said to me, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. So there's a vast area of people in different languages and different nations that she has control over or influences. And in the Old Testament, waters is often a symbol for peoples as well. It says, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication. Sexual looseness is often used symbolically in the Old Testament. Israel was pictured as God's bride, and her unfaithfulness was called adultery. God describes other major powers in the Old Testament. He calls Tyre as harlot. They were going the wrong direction. And Nineveh is harlot. They were not in a committed relationship with God. Israel was in a committed relationship, so to break that was harlotry. It was adultery. But the other nations weren't in a committed relationship to God, so that was harlotry. It's quite different. So they were not in a covenant with the true God. This indicates that the great harlot was not part of the children of Israel. Because if it was Israel, it would be adultery. But it's not Israel, so it's harlotry. Rather, this woman was in bed with the kings of the earth. Like harlots and their clients, they use each other. It's a terrible thing. They willingly participate in her sins, and she willingly participates in theirs. And it says, in the inhabitants of the earth, she's with the kings, so the people who were governed by the kings, the inhabitants of the earth, were made drunk by the wine of her fornication. This corruption spreads to all the subjects in the realm, who do not realize they've been seduced by the great harlot. God said, Satan deceives the whole world. And this has gone out, and this world is deceived in so many ways. And the longer I live, the more I see how that deceit is really there. And the people do not understand and cannot understand what's actually happening and what's happening in the nation and what's happening in their lives. They're going down the wrong road, and it's terrible to watch. Verse 3. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, who was full of names of blasphemy, having 7 heads and 10 horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. Now, a scarlet beast. Scarlet is used of two things in the Bible, royal splendor and also sin. God said, come now, let us reason together, says the Lord, though your sins are like scarlet, they shall be made white as snow. Though they are red as crimson, they shall be like wool. That's Isaiah 1:18 in the NIV. And this beast is also full of names of blasphemy, calling things and people holy that are not holy, and calling titles and so on that are far from the way God, what the true holiness is. Now, it has 7 heads and 10 horns. The harlot arrived in the scene only after the original Roman Empire had fallen. And this is important to realize, that she's riding this beast, but the beast she's riding had 7 heads and 10 horns. If you look at Revelation chapter 13, the first couple of verses, Revelation 13, he said, then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns. And on his horn were 10 crowns, and on his head a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard, his feet like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. The dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. And I saw one of his heads as it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed. And all the world marveled and followed the beast. So they worshiped the dragon, they were really worshiping Satan, who gave authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like the beast, and who is able to make war with him? This is quite an impressive beast that John saw. But back in Revelation 17, it says it had 7 heads. This is one that came on the scene afterward. The woman did not ride on the beast that was the actual Roman Empire. The Roman Empire was said to be wounded in 476 A.D., and it said that that's when the Roman Empire ended. However, that's when they claim it ended. But in 554, less than 100 years later, Justinian of Constantinople established what is known as the Imperial Restoration of the Empire. And since then, since Constantine, this corrupt and immoral harlot often exercised control over or sitting on the Roman Empire. It was dominated by the Catholic Church, but not before that. Only after Constantine was the Catholic Church in charge or able to ride the beast. Beast much stronger, of course, but like a woman riding a horse, the horse is much stronger than she is, but she can direct it wherever she wants it to go if she knows how to ride a horse. And this woman knows how to ride a beast, which is really amazing. And it said the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls. Purple and scarlet, of course, were expensive. And not so much now, but they were in those days. And this woman is shown to be prosperous because she's got purple and scarlet, gold, precious stones, and pearls. Can you imagine a company that had a substantial income but convinced all of its employees to work for nothing? Isn't that amazing? The church has all its employees, they have no salaries. They all take a vow of poverty, and they're dependent on it. You know, for most businesses, salaries is the number one expense. It's the largest expense. And so they are very wealthy, partly because of the way they've organized themselves, that everybody works for free, or nearly free. And it says, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. The golden cup she makes people drink out of is used to make the nations drunk, so they willingly follow the woman in her evil ways. The Jewish New Testament translates it, in her hand was a gold cup filled with the obscene and filthy things produced by her whoring, is the way it's translated in that translation. Going on, verse 5, and on her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots, and of all the abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. Her title was put prominently on her forehead. Now, everyone can identify this woman. It should be clear to identify. Did you know that Roman harlots actually wore labels on their brow inscribed with their names? They weren't hiding what they were doing. They advertised. It was an advertisement. It's unbelievable, but that's what it was. Notice John has informed us of what was in her hand and what was on her forehead. You remember in Revelation, the servants of the beast were marked on their hand and in their forehead. Your hand is what you do. Your forehead is what you think. And so this is what how it goes from there. And she had a name, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots, and of the abominations of the earth. Mystery, something that we could never work out for ourselves. God must show it to us. And Babylon the Great, though identified as Roman, here God reveals her roots, both her religious and ideological roots. We have discussed this. I won't go through it, but the whole thing goes back to the Babylonian mystery religion. Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And it's called she's called the mother of prostitutes. She inspires inspiration. The teachings on Sunday, Christmas, Easter, immortal soul, heaven and hell, and many, many more are all come from this ancient pagan source or ancient pagan source. They don't come from the Bible, as I think everyone here agrees. And it's amazing to follow that around the world today, Catholics and Protestants are cooperating and working together because they recognize they have so much in common. Back when I was in college, we thought, how could they possibly ever work together? Because one recognizes the Pope, and the other one didn't want to have anything to do with the Pope. Well, in that time, things have changed. And doctrine has become less significant. Actual true doctrine, so that you can work with another group even though you don't agree with them on some major points. It's just the way things are today. And of the abominations of the earth, filled with every wicked practice. Seneca called Rome a filthy sewer. James Barclay comments, John's picture of Rome is not in the least exaggerated. It is actually restrained in comparison with some of the pictures which the Romans themselves drew of their own civilization, the way they described their own civilization. So it was really something very bad. Then John said, I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. You know, unrighteous people hate righteous people. That's been true since Cain and Abel. Today, if you look around our society, you'll see that it often rejoices in the wicked when somebody does something bad and gets away with it. And it usually shows contempt who hold high moral standards. The higher moral standards you hold, the less likely the world is to like you. It's just the way it is. He said, and when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. John was astonished at the vision God put before him. He'd now been shown this great false religion would become at the end of the age. This is what he'd been shown. And can you imagine John hearing the angel say that the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints? That must have been very hard for him to hear. but that's what he saw, and that's what he wrote down. Now we come to the section where it'll help us to see where we are today, which is what we're trying to get to here. Verses 7 to 8. But the angel said to me, why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the 7 heads and 10 horns. You know, we're often marvel. He said, why do you marvel? We often marvel at the things we see in the world. And John was no exception. If you go back to Revelation chapter 1, let's have a look at the reason for the revelation, and that'll help us understand why God wrote it. Actually, it's a very sobering point. Revelation 1:1. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him, God gave Jesus the revelation, to show his servants, Christ's servants, and God's servants, of course, things which must shortly take place. The revelation was given to be opened up toward the end of the age when the things that were going to happen would shortly take place. Things which shortly take place. And he sent and signified it by his angel to his servant John, who bore witness of the word of God. When God said something, he wrote it down. And to the testimony of Jesus Christ, when Jesus said something, he wrote it down. And of the things which he saw, the things that God brought to his attention. Blessed is he who reads, and those who hear the words of this prophecy, and keep these things which are written in it. There are things in the book of Revelation to keep, not just to know. And who keep these things which are written in it, for the time is near. He knew when this book is opened, the time would be near. Now, of course, to God, near has a different definition than it does to us in the flesh. But nevertheless, it's near. Now back to Revelation 17. I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and ten horns. The beast that you saw was and is not and will ascend out of the abyss, a bottomless pit, and go into perdition. Now let's go back to Romans 13. Well, I already did cover Romans 13. It was the beast that was going to have this deadly wound, and it was, and it's going to come back out of the pit. I'll tell you the mystery that's there. An ancient kingdom, once present, then gone, would appear again in future. It died, and then it came back to life again. The Roman Empire, whose roots go clear back to Babylon. NIV says, the beast which you saw once was, now is not, and will come up out of the abyss and go to his destruction. Come out of the abyss and go to his destruction. Verse 8, and those who dwell on the earth will marvel, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast that was and is not and yet is. People will be greatly surprised when this returns. And it says they will marvel. But those whose names are written in the book of life from the foundation of the world will understand. God's purposes have been planned from the foundation of the world. And those who serve God, those who follow him, those written in the book of life, have been given understanding of God's plan. And so they will know what's happening. What God's plan is to replace this present corrupt society with his righteous one. That's the short statement of the plan. But to replace this present corrupt society with his righteousness. Now let's remember, God gave this to John about 2,000 years ago. And it's been playing out ever since. Now we'll get into the time more specifically. Verse 9. Here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. These are also seven kings. Five have fallen. One is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. The beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth, and is of the seventh, and is going to perdition. Okay, the world is kind of mixed up on this. They understand some things, but some things they don't. And if they'd understand that, then they'd know where we are in prophecy. Here is the mind that has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. The wise will be given. It's a mystery, but it must be shown. Understanding of this prophecy. Now, I think everybody has heard of the seven hills of Rome. That the city is founded on seven hills. And all the commentaries, I think every one I've checked, mention the seven hills of Rome. That's the seven hills that she sits on. And the seven hills is a common expression. And that's known in the commentary. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown state that the heathen Rome had a national festival. This is the heathen one before the church. Had a national festival called Septimonium, the feast of the seven-hilled cities. I quote Plutarch on that. And on the imperial coins, just as here, she is presented as a woman seated on seven hills. But in the church, we have an additional understanding. That teaching is right, but it doesn't give you the whole picture. They miss a very revealing application. In the Bible, mountains and hills can also symbolize governments and nations. And the angel explains that in the next point, in verse 10. It can also represent that. He said in verse 10, there are seven kings. Five have fallen. That tells you that they go one after the other. It's not talking about a physical hill. It's talking about a government that comes up. Five are fallen. One is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. So the seven kings, which the woman rides, are seven successive restorations of the Roman Empire, as well as the seven physical hills. Now notice that phrase again. Five are fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. Now, it's an astonishing thing that John was projected forward to the time of the sixth revival of the Roman Empire. Five have fallen. One is, the sixth, and the next one, the seventh, is yet to come. So he was projected forward to that time. Now we understand the seventh revival happened in the time of Mussolini and Hitler. Benito Mussolini, who was in power from 1922 to 1945. But later he allied with Hitler. He was in Italy, but not the whole group together. He joined with Hitler, who was in power who was the dictator from 1933 to 1945. So it's the late 20s and the early 30s. Now, John was taken forward to that time, if our understanding is correct, to understand exactly that's when it was. That's what he saw in the vision. So the restoration took John forward in time to just the beginning of the sixth restoration of the Roman Empire. And I remember my astonishment when it first dawned on me, and I don't remember when it did. That's the time when Mr. Armstrong began to understand the book of Revelation. It was in the late 20s and the early 30s. He had just come in. He was baptized in 1927. And he started learning these things, and then he got to see and understand the book of Revelation. Nobody can open the book of Revelation but Jesus Christ. If you understand the book of Revelation, it had to be that Jesus Christ opened it to somebody and explained it to you and to me. And it was put forward like that, and there it was. And he's been publishing that book from that time. It was the book of Revelation revealed at last, or opened at last, however it was. Now, when you think about that, it was time they were just building up there, Mussolini and Hitler getting to their little empire together there, that taking over neighbors and beginning to rule, and that came and that went in 1945. So now we are past the sixth, and we're waiting for the seventh. That's where we are now, in the broadest sense of the word. The angel continued, the other has not yet come, and when he comes, he must continue a short time. The final revival will be a short one. Thank God. Previous chapters in Revelation have shown how destructive that's going to be. Now, verse 11 is misunderstood. It's not that complicated when you understand it, but it takes a little understanding. The beast that was not and is not himself is also the eighth and is of the seventh and is going to perdition. As I say, it can seem confusing, but it's not. The woman rides on seven revivals of the Roman Empire. But there was one beforehand. Before the revival started, you had to have the empire. So that was the first one. Then there's seven restorations, and that makes eight. So if you count the original Roman Empire from 31 BC to 476, which the woman never rode, it makes the last kingdom, which is the seventh that she rides on, actually the eighth. The beast to come, but not yet here, will be the eighth. Okay? So we got the revivals. Now we got to get to one more specific. And that's in verse 12. The ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have received no power as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. These are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. They will actually give their power and authority and be submissive to this individual called the beast. They will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And those who are with him are called, chosen, and faithful. Remember in verse 3, the beast had seven heads and ten horns. We have seen the seven heads are the successive revivals of the Roman Empire. Now we're told who the ten horns are. The ten horns which you saw are ten kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. John was being shown events that are still in the future, the seventh and the last revival. As I said before, we're between the sixth and the seventh revival. Now think about this. John wrote this around 90 AD, when the Roman Empire was still going strong and was going to go for quite a long time, several centuries after him, after John. And he was told that these future ten kings would be contemporaneous. The seven heads are not contemporaneous. They come one after the other. Five are fallen, one is, one's yet to come. But the ten horns are contemporaneous. They receive power for 1 hour as kings with the beast. They have a short time. These have one mind. They're all contemporaneous. And they will give their power and authority to the beast. Satan stirs them up to make this final decision to objectively, abjectly, and totally give their authority to the beast and submit to him. And that's when their trouble really begins, when they get into that situation. Verse 14, the first part. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings. This is not difficult to understand, but the commentaries have great difficulty explaining it. This verse places the ten kings at the time of Jesus Christ's return to the earth. He's going to defeat them. This is the army that Jesus Christ will confront and destroy at his return. Revelation 11:18 tells us that he will destroy those who destroy the earth. The battle pictured is actually pictured in Revelation 19, which we covered a few years ago. And he said, the second part of verse 14, and those who are with him are called, chosen, and faithful. These three descriptors reveal who Christ's servants really are. It makes it very plain. They're called. They received an individual invitation from the Father to participate in God's kingdom. Called. Then they're chosen. They responded to God's call. They repented of their former way of life, turned from it. They were baptized, and they were given God's Holy Spirit. And then they started to grow spiritually to follow their leader, Jesus Christ. You know, he said that many are called, but few chosen. More are invited to participate in the kingdom than actually accept the invitation. And there's one more category. They're called, they're chosen, and they're faithful. That is, they stayed with it to the end. Matthew 24:13 says, but he who endures to the end will be saved. Matthew 24:13. even during the terrible times when this final revival dominates the whole earth, these servants remain faithful. As we mentioned many times in the past, whoopamoni, that staying faithful, standing fast no matter what, God's children must remain faithful to the end. So let's just review the picture that we've been given here. In future, at the end of this age, a wealthy, powerful, spiritual harlot whose roots go back to Babylon will be riding a beast, the final revival of the Roman Empire. Many kings and many nations will be deceived and dominated by this group. She will persecute God's servants. 10 kings will join themselves to this beast, and they will fight Jesus Christ at his return. So where are we now? As I said earlier, the sixth revival of the Roman Empire has already come and gone. Let's go back to Daniel chapter 2. We're finished in Revelation 17. Back to Daniel chapter 2. We covered this not so long ago, but let's look at it again. And in verse 31, he explains to Nebuchadnezzar the dream he had, which nobody else could explain, including him, unless God gave it to him. He says, "You, O king," Daniel 2:31, "were watching, and behold, a great image. The great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. The image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You watched while a stone was cut out without hands, no human involvement, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth." That's the dream. And you see that Jesus is going to hit that thing on the feet, 10 toes, and then it just disappears. And that whole system gone, just blows away. It's just taken completely away. No longer exists. So we're waiting for that final seventh revival, which the stone, cut out without hands, will smash on the 10 toes, and the whole system comes crashing down and disappears. Let me show you another prophecy. Genesis chapter 22. This is Abraham and his willingness to offer Isaac. Exodus. Genesis 22. And let's begin in verse 15. Then the angel of the Lord, this is when God steps in. Then the angel of the Lord, capital A on the angel, which is correct. Then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time out of heaven, saying, "By myself I have sworn, says the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, blessing I will bless you, and multiply I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven and as the sand which is on the seashore. And your descendants will possess the gates of your enemies. In your seed, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed because you have obeyed my voice." So Abraham returned to his young men. They arose and went to Beersheba. God blessed Abraham and his descendants with abundance and with gates. Later, the prophecy was divided into two groups. I won't go through that today. But let's look to Genesis chapter 49. Genesis chapter 49. This is where Jacob pronounces a blessing on his 12 sons. Genesis 49, verse 22. And we'll look at Joseph. Earlier in Genesis 48, Jacob tells Joseph, "We're going to double your inheritance. Instead of you being one son, you're going to be two sons, and your sons will take my name. And they'll be like Reuben, and they'll be like the other tribes." So they were going to have Ephraim and Manasseh. Or as a Jewish tour guide once said, Ephraim and Manasseh. I don't know if I'm doing that right or not, but anyway. I said Ephraim and Manasseh. He didn't know what I was talking about. Tells you my pronunciation. Going to Joseph now. Joseph, Genesis 49:22, is a fruitful bough by a well. His branches run over the wall, spreads out everywhere. The archers have bitterly grieved him, shot at him, and hated him. Oh, yes, Joseph is hated. But his bow remained in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. For there is the shepherd, from there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. By the God of your father, he will help you. And by the Almighty, who will bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lie beneath, blessings of the breasts and of the womb, the blessing of your father have excelled the blessings of my ancestors. Up to the uttermost bound of the everlasting hills, they shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him who is separated from his brothers. Joseph's life wasn't an easy one. He was separated from his brothers. And that's mentioned a couple times there in that passage, in Genesis. He was separated from his brothers. Since the early 1800s, the children of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, as we say in English, have been given national prominence that was promised to Abraham's descendants. First, Britain was a great empire. Ephraim was the leading nation on earth for quite a long time. Then, since World War II, the United States, Manasseh, has been the leading nation on the earth. Together, at that time, they possessed the gates of their enemies, and that meant they controlled the seas and commerce. And they've been very prosperous and blessed. And God has kept his promise. I think everybody, at least in terms of that national prominence and wealth, there's still another promise. There's still more promises to come. Abraham died not having received the promises, but God did fulfill his promise to Abraham to make his Joseph's sons prosperous on the earth in an astonishing way that is really remarkable. And the more you realize it, the more it's just astonishing. But let's go to Leviticus chapter 26. Leviticus chapter 26. Leviticus 26, and let's begin in verse 14. The first 13 verses are talking about the blessings that would come upon Israel if they were faithful to God and kept his covenant. But in verse 14, until the end of the chapter, which we won't cover all that, he goes on and says, what's going to happen if you don't do it right? But if you do not obey me and do not observe all these commandments, and you despise my statutes, and brethren, his statutes are despised today. If your soul abhors my judgments, then today that's how it is. So that you do not perform all my commandments, but break my covenant, I will do this to you. What's the first thing he mentions? I will even appoint terror over you. First, terror, fear. And of course, we now have a big problem with terrorism in the world. Over you, wasting diseases and fever, which shall consume the eyes and cause sorrow of heart. And you shall sow your seed in vain, for your enemies shall eat it. I will set my face against you, and you shall be defeated by your enemies. We've had more and more troubles. It used to be when America and Britain got in, that was the end of it. They worked together in the Second World War, and it was over. Since that time, they're not over. They keep going. They don't finish the job. I will set my face against you so that you're defeated by your enemies. Those who hate you shall reign over you. Those who don't like them will reign over them. And you shall flee when no one pursues. After all this, if you do not obey me, then I will punish you seven times more. He does that several times here. I will break the pride of your power. You have power, but not the pride of it that goes with it. I will break the pride of your power. I will make your heaven like iron and your earth like bronze, which means cold, barren skies and scorched earth. And your strength shall be spent in vain. For your land shall not yield its produce, The land shall not yield its produce, nor the trees of the land yield their fruit. We still have lots of fruit. We still have great prosperity, but we're going down a track here. He said, going on, then if you walk contrary to me and are not willing to obey me, I will bring on you 7 times more plagues according to your sins. I'll send wild beasts among you, which shall rob you of your children, destroy your livestock, and make you few in number. And your highways shall be desolate. Well, our highways aren't desolate right now, but we are going toward troubles and difficulties. We are now witnessing, and the rest of the chapter, things get even worse as it goes terribly down. But Ephraim, now we're witnessing America's national prominence in decline. And it seems almost rapid decline. Ephraim and Manasseh control fewer gates of their enemies. They've all gone back, not all, but most of them have gone back to the original landowners. And the pride of our power is diminishing. We're not taking the lead. We are the greatest debtor nation of all time. And it doesn't seem to upset too many people. And it might be a generation thing that older Americans get more alarmed about this debt than younger ones seem to, but it's the greatest debt we've ever seen. And even worse, our leaders seem totally unable to slow it, let alone stop it from the spending. And from everything I read, brethren, the true picture is far worse than we hear, because we have all kinds of unfunded things that just aren't going right. But we keep them off budget. We keep them off the books, do it in various ways. And that's not even counted in the official figures. Somebody counts it, but not in the official figures, or not in the ones that are given. Another thing I noticed, there are fewer voters in Republican primaries last week. Now, the early ones, Iowa was plus 2.4, New Hampshire was plus 3.5, and South Carolina was plus 36. That was really a lot more voters. However, last week, Florida was down 14%. Minnesota was down 22%. Nevada was down 26%. Are people tuning out? Are people dropping out? When President Obama gave his first speech to the joint sessions of Congress, 52 million people watched. The next year, 48 million people watched. In 2011, 43 million people watched. In 2012, just 38 million. It just keeps dropping, dropping, dropping. It's like, I don't want to hear. I don't want to know. Peggy Noonan had a column this morning about all the negative ads and what they're going to do long term. And she's upset by it because it's destroying things. It's destroying people's confidence in everybody. You can say some bad stuff about anybody. And she calls a curse on those people who do it, who take a palsy in their hands and all kind of stuff like that. She was really upset because she sees it destroying her children. Children hear all this stuff. And what is it? What's the talk about their government? What's the talk about what's happening with that? It's a terrible thing that's happening. Internationally, China is on the rise. The Middle East is increasingly unstable. People have difficulty picturing Iran with nuclear weapons because what they say when they don't have them. And the hostility they have to just about everybody, especially Christians and Jews. Russia is becoming unstable. Mr. Putin's having some problems. And respect for America all around the world is waning. At the same time, Europe is struggling to stay solvent. They keep telling us they solved the Greek debt problem, and everybody kind of breathes, and the stock market goes up, and then the next week they say, well, we haven't quite solved it. And they're still working with it. They're still struggling with it. Frustrating debts in some nations are weighing down Europe's economy. And their economy is slowing down. They're actually turning reverse in some cases. So they're talking about greater fiscal union, they're calling it, which means we'll tell you how you run your economy. That's what it means, which is what exactly these nations have to do, said they will do later on. When I was attending Ambassador, I wrote this in a pastor's update some months ago or years ago, what would make these quite distinct nations of Europe give up their sovereignty to fulfill the prophecy? The 10 nations, the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. These are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. What would make somebody do that? We had traveled a bit in Europe by that time, and it was clear to us as students that the nation certainly won one mind back then. The iron and clay analogy was very much easier to understand because they didn't get along. They were together next door, but they didn't get along. But the rise of Hitler gave us a clue. He came to power during financial disruptions caused by high inflation in the 1920s, unbelievable inflation that affects the Germans still today, and by severe unemployment during the Great Depression in the 1930s. They were hit especially hard. So they turned to the right. They looked for somebody to run things, and they looked for a strong leader. And they got one. So it seemed back then to my classmates and me that the likely catalyst would be another severe financial catastrophe. In desperate situations, people often do desperate things. We also wondered if history might repeat itself. Do you remember anciently, who was it that turned on Joseph? His own brothers. They were moved by envy and hostility against him. Of course, Joseph wasn't too wise. Hey, you're all going to bow down to me. Oh, they love to hear that. They love to hear that. Will his brothers once again put him in a pit while they discuss what to do with him? Will Reuben once again recommend selling him to the Ishmaelites as a slave, whoever the Ishmaelites may be today? Will Joseph once again be carried off to Egypt? There are prophecies that suggest that. Where are we now in prophecy? We're in the time between the 6th and the 7th revival of the great harlot riding a scarlet beast that was full of names of blasphemy. Now, the great harlot doesn't have a lot of power today, and see how we get to that spot. I don't know how it's going to happen, but God said it's going to happen. That means it's going to happen. The sons of Joseph rose to power and influence, and they benefited the world in many ways. Now they're in decline, while their enemies are gaining in strength. It's not a good picture. But let's remember an important thing for the church. Those who are with the Lord of Lords and the King of Kings, when these kings are around, are called and chosen and faithful.